From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, we'll hear from some of the people with the highest stakes on San Francisco's November ballot.
If we could organize homeless people to vote, we would be able to swing elections.
Then we visit a Bayview program where Black girls connect and thrive.
If you're like not valuing yourself, like it's just gonna keep you from saying anything to anybody instead of standing up for yourself.
And we'll stay in Bayview to delve into a question from our Hey Area file. Listener Zeke Cullen notices that Bayview street names are nearly all alphabetical.
Except for one that's skipped where the letter street beginning with the letter O should be.
You asked and we're answering today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Affordable housing continues to be a hot-button topic in San Francisco this election season. There are 7 housing and homelessness measures on San Francisco's ballot, but we haven't heard much from those most impacted, the homeless. How do they feel about voting? KALW's Lucy Kang went to the Tenderloin to find out.
You're a registered voter? Would you like to be?
Lisa Galinas is sitting at a folding table near the intersection of Turk and Hyde in San Francisco. She and Laura Sinai are registering people in the Tenderloin to vote. They have stacks of voter registration forms scattered all over the table. Galinas counts how many they've collected so far today.
2, 4. Oh, 7. We got 9 more, Laura.
All right.
She's trying to match the 16 registration forms they collected yesterday. And Galinas is asking everyone who passes by if they've registered. Everyone.
You guys registered voters?
Yes, been
did
it already.
They're doing this for Tenderloin Votes, an organization that's getting out the vote in one of the neighborhoods with the lowest voter turnout in the city.
Registered voters, sir?
In the precinct where we're standing right now, less than half of residents turn out to vote in the June primaries. That drops to 32% in the next precinct over, compared to nearly 60% in the city overall.
You registered voters, sweetie? How old are you?
And you can't talk about the Tenderloin without talking about its vast street population. San Francisco's District 6, the Tenderloin in SoMa, is where the majority of the city's unsheltered homeless people stay, and where they can vote, too. Galinas herself used to be homeless in San Francisco.
And it ain't no joke, and it's not fun.
Well, when you were homeless, did you vote?
No, no.
How come?
It was never offered.
That's the scenario that Tenderloin Votes is trying to change.
Someone once said if they could organize the homeless people in the city, they could have an army of 10,000.
Jesse Johnson is the founder of Tenderloin Votes, and he's made this neighborhood his home now for the last 2 decades. He says it all started back in 2014 with this one idea.
Yes, if we could organize homeless people to vote, we would be able to swing elections.
There's actually closer to 7,000 homeless people in the city. So, is that really enough to make a difference in the elections? It depends which race you're talking about. For the presidential election, 7,000 votes are a drop in the bucket. But if you're talking about, say, the close state Senate race between District 6 Supervisor Jane Kim and District 8 Supervisor Scott Weiner, well, then there's more of a chance to make a difference. Kim beat Weiner by a mere 669 votes in June. The two are facing off against each other in November. And San Francisco voters will also be deciding on 7 city ballot measures dealing with homelessness or affordable housing.
Working people and poor people need to have a voice. You know, people in the Tenderloin, they're immensely generous and immensely, you know, engaged with each other. But that doesn't translate into voting.
Right now, that's somewhat true. I found that less than a quarter of homeless adults in the city have registered to vote in San Francisco as of mid-September. Why so low? One barrier is filling out the voter registration form, which asks for both the physical address and a mailing address. What do you do if you're homeless?
A lot of homeless people don't know. I certainly didn't know. That's one of the reasons I got involved in the TL Votes.
That's Kat Calloway, one of Tenderloin Votes first members and a close friend of Jesse Johnson. She's lived on the streets of San Francisco for the last half a decade. She's an election poll worker who regularly attends city government meetings and also helps people to register. And she's had to figure out how to vote despite all the barriers of being homeless.
Are you planning to vote in November?
Oh, hell yeah, I've always voted. You bet.
Calloway explains to me that many homeless folks write in general delivery as their mailing address on the voter form. That's where you pick up your mail directly from the post office.
Then you can indicate a cross street that is, you know, closest to where you generally spend your time.
But Calloway says it's not just logistical barriers that keep homeless people from voting.
So many people, you know, it's not that they just don't vote, it's that they think the system has let them down and they don't want to support that system.
She thinks we're missing something big when we miss out on all those aggregate voices that aren't being heard through the decision-making process. For example, Calloway says people who are housed can't understand what it's like to be on the streets.
As long as you've got some place to go back to, I don't think you really know what it's like.
The fact that so few homeless people vote may have very real policy implications, especially in a state where so many decisions are made at the ballot. And right now, what California looks like from the voting booth is very different from who Californians actually are. According to a recent Public Policy Institute of California study, the state's electorate currently looks
predominantly white, predominantly homeowners, predominantly older, predominantly college-educated, and middle to upper income.
That's Mark Baldessari, president and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California. The study also found that the higher your income, the more likely you are to vote. How does that affect policy? States where many more high-income people turn out to vote than low-income people tend to have larger gaps between rich and poor.
Likely voters lean towards identifying themselves with the haves,
while non-voters tend to describe themselves as the have-nots. And non-voters are more likely to want the government to spend more money on social services like schools and health care. But their opinions don't get counted in the elections, and those votes add up. Here's Kat Calloway again.
I don't really believe that my vote counts, but I believe that my vote and your vote and this vote over here, even if we vote differently as a voice, you know, it counts, and they have to listen to us.
Meanwhile, the push to make those voices heard continues. Lisa Galinas is still on the streets of the Tenderloin, asking people if they've signed up to vote.
You registered voter, sir?
I am, thank you.
Be patient. Patience is a virtue.
And why does she do what she does?
So they can have better quality of living and better housing.
For her, it's as simple as that. Tenderloin Votes will be out in the neighborhood every week leading up to the final registration deadline, registering people to vote, one person at a time. In the Tenderloin, I'm Lucy Kang for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. High up on a Bayview Hunters Point Hill is a tiny apartment building. From the outside, it looks like any other building on the block, but as you approach, sounds of laughing, singing, yelling, stomping, squealing, and music spill out the door and the windows. Gathered inside is a group of black girls, old friends, new friends, cousins, sisters, and neighbors. Every day after school, nearly 30 of them make their way here to be part of a makeshift girls-only clubhouse called Girls 2000. The girls can learn to cook for themselves, they help each other with homework, they work on art projects, talk about boys, and they learn how to grow. Reporter Mwende Hasey has their story.
A cluster of third and fourth graders take over the living room of the Girls 2000 headquarters after dinner.
Okay, fuck that over. You guys are waiting for me to count. I remember you guys. Everybody's gonna count out loud together.
An older girl named Carlina Sherrill teaches them some moves. Step, step, punch, punch, spin in a circle, and high five your neighbor.
5, 6, 7, 8.
1, 2, 3.
If you can edge your way around the little dancers, make your way up the staircase to the computer lab, which is really just a bedroom with a few computers, a love seat, and lots of books. Here is where the big girls congregate.
There are many communities that have denied power in society, that were denied. Come on, Arisha.
Six teenage girls work, or pretend to work, on class assignments. One looks at library books on a computer, another reads a book and texts on her phone. 15-year-old Rainisha Mims works on an essay.
I'm doing an essay about Black women, how they've been manipulated, abandoned, sexually assaulted. They can't get jobs because of their race or their sexual gender. So it's just ridiculous, and I think it needs to stop.
Rainisha's being raised by her single mom, which means her mom can't always get to the school and talk to Rainisha's teachers. So if Rainisha needs someone to go to school and advocate for her, girls will be on her side.
It's like very important for you to have that balance and that support.
That support gets reflected in almost everything the girls do here, like the essay Rainisha's writing about Black women and oppression.
I have a picture right here of a girl's mouth covered, because I was like, Black people, like Black women in particular, they don't get a chance to speak, and like they're not valued as much as other races are.
Photos of Black female leaders adorn the walls of the apartment's living room. Michelle Obama, Harriet Tubman, Angela Davis, Rosa Parks.
I have another picture. It says, oppression can only survive through silence. And I think that is true. If you're like always being doubted and like not valuing yourself, like it's just going to keep you from saying anything to anybody instead of standing up for yourself. That's like with bullying or with like, you know, different places, you don't have a voice, but I think you have a mouth, you should use it.
Speaking up is encouraged here. Everyone is allowed to be themselves, even though sometimes the girls get a little too comfortable.
I said no selfies. We're going to do no selfie policy.
That's Ashley Blanco. She's 28 years old and works full-time with Girls 2000.
I don't want them to see themselves as just ratchet or hood or ghetto or whatever.
Ashley is a San Francisco native, raised in the Mission District. On her lapel is a button that reads, "We are the last 3%, outlined with the continent of Africa. 3% is how many African American people she believes still currently populate the city. The last census says those numbers are closer to 6%. Regardless, it's a population in rapid decline. Ashley says she wears the button because she wants folks to know Black people still matter in San Francisco, despite the dwindling numbers. She especially wants the girls to understand.
Really, when I approached them, it's just like, I'm you from the future.
Ashley went to Howard University. For grad school, she studied urban education policy at Brown. But she came back to San Francisco to work with young people because she wanted to make an impact.
Because I am them, you know, and they are me. So I always have that thing, like, you need to do well. And not because you're going to take care of me, but because I don't want to hear you're doing poorly down the line.
Ashley heads to the kitchen to serve dessert. Tonight, they're having banana bread. Ashley and the other adults who run the program do the bulk of the cooking. The girls sometimes chop up fruits and veggies. The food they eat is either donated or grown in their very own garden.
But that grapevine about to take that.
It's gonna take the whole.
It's gonna, like, it's gonna take that fence all the way down to almost the end where the blackberries are at.
The garden is a 20-minute walk from the apartment, way up one of the steepest hills in the Bayview. It's been here for 20 years.
The plan is, Bale, is we taking all of the greens out of beds and we're transplanting. That's what me and her are doing now. Like, where are we going?
It's 9 a.m., early for a Saturday morning of garden work. The girls trickle into the garden slowly, looking kind of sleepy.
Why do you want to grow that vegetable in the garden this summer? And I hope you know what plants you can grow in the summer in the garden. Ooh, y'all better know.
Okay. That's Brandy Mack. She's the director of Girls 2000. She grew up around farming.
We got three apple trees over there.
Brandy and a group of eight girls gather in a circle by the greenhouse. This is a little ritual they have before getting to work, a way to see how everyone's feeling. Brandy has everyone check in and say what they want to grow this summer.
My name is Maji, and
Strawberries. Yes. Because I like strawberries.
My name's Lachey. Is it watermelon?
Yes, you know it, girl.
Watermelon.
We got sugar babies in the greenhouse. Sugar babies.
The sugar babies will be for the girls to sell at the Saturday Alemany Farmers Market, along with other fruits and veggies they grow. But first,
we're going to be transplanting a lot of things today. That's going to be the name of the game. Transplanting and weeding, because you clearly know our cousin Bermuda grass always creeps up, right?
Someone rolls out a speaker and turns on the radio full blast. The girls spread out amongst the 30 different raised beds and settle into the morning's work. They self-organize into teams. Some transplant mint, some get rid of compost, and others attack that pesky Bermuda grass.
Good job, Isis. Good job. Keep going down the rows.
Brandy likes to use gardening as a metaphor for how Girls 2000 is cultivating the girls' sense of self.
That if you spend too much time with just one thing, you're draining yourself. The idea of getting in there and having different species work together is what allows you to self-reflect.
Self-reflection is somewhat of a luxury when you grow up in the unstable conditions of a neighborhood like Bayview Hunters Point. But it's important, especially for teenagers, to learn to get out of their heads a bit and think about others.
Clearly, that's my underground mission, is to train a whole bunch of women farmers. Take over the world, Pinky. No, but what I do know is they'll have self-sufficiency.
Self-sufficiency, self-reflection, and self-confidence. This group of girls in a San Francisco neighborhood many people consider disadvantaged are rich. Rich with the support of mentors, multiple mother figures, female friends, and opportunities to explore themselves. This group has permanence because of loving cultivation, not just for the garden, but for human culture as well. For Cross Currents, I'm Wenda Hasey.
That story originally aired in June 2015. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Our listener, Zeke Cullen, also lives in the Bayview neighborhood, and there's something about one of the street names that bothers him. He notices that they're alphabetical.
Except for one that's skipped, where the letter street beginning with the letter O should be.
Where's that O street? Zeke posed that puzzle to our Hey Area project, where you get to ask the questions and we assign a reporter. In this case, it's KALW's Stephen Short. Let's see if he found a satisfactory answer.
Meet Zeke Cullen.
I've been listening to KALW for 8 years. I work at the Exploratorium, and I like maps.
As a fan of maps, he knows the avenues and streets in his neighborhood.
The avenues to run east to west are LaSalle, McKinnon, Newcomb, Oakdale, Palou.
But the streets, in the other direction, don't have that O designation.
Lane, Mendel, Newhall, Phelps, Quint, and Rankin.
Zeke's question has taken me to the other side of San Francisco from the Bayview, to one of the numbered streets in the Inner Richmond, where I've arranged to meet John Freeman at his house.
My name is John Freeman. I'm a native San Franciscan, and I am a historian of San Francisco.
His particular interest in the history of San Francisco is the period of Reconstruction following the earthquake and fire of 1906. Freeman is the author of an article for the online Encyclopedia of San Francisco titled Street Naming Controversy, 1909. There was no master plan to early San Francisco, so the name of a street could change to something totally different in the next block for no apparent reason. And there was duplication. The Board of Supervisors saw the post-earthquake rebuilding phase as a unique opportunity to straighten out this mess, or at least some of it.
You have a new expanding city. We're now moving out to the margins. How are you going to address the question where you have duplications of streets?
The commission could also take advantage of the fact that not many people lived in the area now known as the Bayview. But while not many people lived there, they did work there.
That was where the slaughterhouses were. That was the least desirable part of town.
All of which brings us back to the question at hand.
Whatever happened to O? I went back to the maps. There's nothing on the in the city directory that even talks about this portion of the city.
Freeman did find an O Street South in that part of town on a map from 1872, but it wasn't there for long.
By 1876 Humphrey maps, we've got no O Street South at all. It simply had disappeared. Where did it go? Why did it happen?
Hey, it's my job to ask the questions. So, John, where did it go? Why did it happen?
My conclusion is that it just was left out accidentally.
And consider this. It was probably never there. Basically, the maps showed grids of streets that only existed on those maps. And it's not just Bayview. According to the city surveyor's office, the same thing is happening right now on Treasure Island. Freeman says the city directories dealt with streets on the ground, those actually in place. So he's convinced there were no streets graded in the Bayview at the time of the renaming project. Those streets were just conceptual.
This is way out in the margins of the city, and it did not have a well-developed infrastructure that had more stockyards and rooming houses. So nobody was paying attention to that kind of thing.
That sounds possible, but it also sounds unlikely, since the head of the Street Renaming Commission was Charles Murdoch, a member of the Board of Supervisors, whose trade was quality printing.
So he was very conscious of the letters of the alphabet, that's for sure.
Murdoch, this man whose work dealt with proper spelling, thought it was lazy to just use a number or a letter without a name to designate a street. Yet he was lazy enough to not even put an O in this district as a placeholder?
Well, he's taking what he was given. He was given an 1876 map that had taken the O out anyway, and he wasn't going to get creative and say, oh, you know what, we need to have another meeting and let's put an O in there. That wasn't where he was going.
Where he was going was giving the streets of San Francisco some cohesion.
It's not like a lot of little villages that it had been prior to the earthquake. It's now becoming a more integrated city, and so you have to have a smart system to address that.
Chairman Murdoch himself wrote that the job of the renaming commission was to correct only the most confusing of the street names, quote, leaving undisturbed much that is to be regretted but can be endured. It's regrettable that O Street was overlooked, but it wasn't as if the cattle being led to slaughter at the time were expecting any mail. And mail delivery was another major reason for these corrections.
The second part of that was it was driving the post office crazy.
An estimated 500 letters a day were mishandled because of street name confusion. I consulted my copy of the definitive Thomas Brothers map book to get back to Zeke Cullen's place, where I gave him the news. So there, O Street wasn't important enough to be noticed. What do you think of that?
You're right, it's a very unsatisfying answer. I mean, there was a whole 1909 street naming process that went through, and it was a lot of back and forth between a lot of people. The pastor from the All Hallows Church was mad about somebody's name being left out or not enough Irish names. So there was definitely a lot of debate about it.
Unsatisfying or not, that appears to be the case. But I have another disappointment for Zeke. I show him my Thomas Brothers maps and ask him to find not the missing O Street, but the street where he lives.
It runs east-west, so it's an avenue, and it would be La Salle. And they have it here with nope. It's not here.
So your street's still, now the whole Bayview doesn't.
The Thomas Guide? The street I'm actually living on. My address is not in the Thomas Guide. Huh. Well, we'll have to have a word with these folks. What do they know about making maps anyway? The Thomas Brothers.
Harump. Harump, I say. Somewhere in the still uncharted Bayview, I'm Stephen Short. For Cross Currents.
If you have a question that's nagging you, ask. ask us and we'll report on it. It's our Hey Area project. Find it on our website, kalw.org. And that's our show for today. Our team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jürgen Klemm, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Beatrice Thomas, and Bowen Wang. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the Night Animals from San Francisco. They're a bit secretive, even wearing masks on stage, so go check them out. They'll be at Smiley's Saloon in Bolinas on Friday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. We are the Alamo Kids.